Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Ellen, I really like your hair. Not on. Without it.
This is so. Why didn't you tell me this in private?
Well, I just didn't feel it was my place.
No, your place is on network television. Huh? Would you like these? What do you suggest I do with all of these now, huh?
Well, there must be some needy bald people.
Hey, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN. So veteran comic writer, producer, actor, director, novelist, the legendary Carl Reiner has been at the center of American comedy for nearly seven decades. From his days on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour, The 2,000-Year-Old Man with Mel Brooks, writer, director, producer, and actor as Alan Brady on the Emmy Award-winning The Dick Van Dyke Show, which is the focus of his new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born, to Broadway, the movies launching the film career of Steve Martin, his roles in the Ocean's 11 movie trilogy, ongoing guest starring roles on television's biggest shows, a New York Times bestselling author, nearly a dozen Emmy Awards, a Grammy, inducted into the Television Hall of Fame, a recipient of the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Carl Reiner has seen and done it all, and he has never stopped. He is a television pioneer. He is a comedy legend. He is Mr. Carl Reiner. Mr. Reiner, a pleasure having you on the show tonight.
It was a pleasure to hear my credits. I didn't know I was so good.
You are amazing. You are amazing. Absolutely. Well, terrific new book, by the way, about the Dick Van Dyke Show that we'll talk about a little bit. You just said you just got your shipment in of these very heavy, high-quality books, so I'm very excited to get my copy.
You know, the thing that makes them heavy is that our publisher decided, because we have over 230 photos in it, that the photos will be produced better on the very best paper there is, and the very best paper is very heavy.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, anyway, it's a coffee table size, so a coffee table can handle it.
So can I.
Wait a
Well, you know, I knew, Carl, you grew up in the Bronx. You were the son of a watchmaker. When you graduated from high school, you've talked about this before, your GPA wasn't the best, and you weren't really thinking college at the time, so you took a job as a machinist helper in the millinery trade. What changed all that?
Well, it changed that, believe it or not. You know how they say, get the people off the government's back? Well, because FDR instituted a thing called the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. A lot of people like me found their careers. He gave free acting. There was a place in New York where you're in Center Street where you can get free acting classes by the WPA subsidized it. And musicians were studied at places they never could afford. Painters were, gone to school and ended up painting some of the greatest murals and post offices that to this day are still lauded. Well, I was 16 or 17, and my brother found a thing in the New York Daily News say free acting classes at New York Center Street, and that was the WPA. And I went there, and this woman, Mrs. Whitmore, I'll never forget her, she said, on the first day, she said, we are now going to learn a soliloquy from Shakespeare, but we're not going to do one of the common ones, one that Hamlet does. We're going to do Gertrude's speech on the death of Ophelia, or drowning. And to this day, yesterday, I was talking about this, and I memorized it when I was 16 years old, and I've never...
And you still know it.
You want to hear it?
Yeah, let's hear it.
There is a willow grows aslant a brook that shows his hoar leaves in the glassy stream. There with fantastic garlands did she come, with crowflowers, nettles, daisies, and long purples that liberal shepherds give a grosser name, but our gold maids do dead men's fingers call them. There with her coronet clambering to hang, an envious sliver broke, and down her weedy trophies in a cell fell into the weeping brook. Her clothes spread wide and wormy-like whilst they bore her up, at which time she chanted snatches of old tunes, as in one incapable of her own distress. And then, sadly, her clothes heavy with drink pulled the poor wretch from her melodious lay to muddy death. Now, that's something I learned when I was 16.
Never forgot it. Fantastic. It's like almost 80 years ago. That is amazing. That must have made an impression on you, though, taking this class, obviously.
But you know, that and the fact when, after I did summer theater for 2 years, I went on a Shakespearean repertory tour, and I say this to any actor, if you want to fully get your wardrobe and your wardrobe, your mind correctly, do Shakespeare. I say if you've worked in Shakespeare, you're ready for anything.
Absolutely. Wow. That's amazing that you still remember.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I hadn't said it until last night. Mel Brooks was over, and I said, somebody's calling. I told him, you're calling today. And I mentioned the fact that he's going to talk about my, and we got to this, and he said, do you remember it? And I did it last night for the first time in years.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And while you were doing this, Carl, and doing these classes, you were working during the day, and just like every aspiring actor, you know, you traveled from the Bronx to Manhattan at night to take your classes. I mean, this is something you really wanted to do.
Oh, there's no question about it. So when the movies did it to me, when I saw what Ronald Coleman can do, I wanted to be Ronald Coleman. To this day, I would still like to be. My favorite movie of all time is Random Harvest. And I have seen it 5 times because I get pleasure. Like, you know, I'm an MC at heart, and I love pointing to things and saying, watch this, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Pavarotti. Well, I like to see people's reaction to watching Random Harvest. There's never been a time in the 5 times I've showed it in the last few years that there's not a smile and a tear on the face of the couple. I usually watch with a couple, I'll say, you know, married couple.
Yep.
You want to cry and smile at the same time.
I just wrote it down. I'm going to watch it myself. See, there
you have it. And please call me after it. I want to know if you react. If you don't, then you've got no heart.
Okay, no, I will. I'm going to watch this. I'm going to absolutely watch it. I'm going to watch it. I know you got a job acting at the old Gilmore Theater on 64th Street. You were in the summer up at the Adirondacks in their 40s when you met your wife of 65 years, Estelle. And soon after, you were in the Army. You were on your way to Iwo Jima when you were reassigned to a special entertainment unit. So that was a pretty good deal.
That was an amazing deal because I didn't know where I was going. I was on Detachment 18, and I went to see a G.I. Hamlet done in Hawaii by Maurice Evans and my friend Howie Morris, who I met in the NYA Radio Workshop, another government-sponsored program. We got $22 a month for doing these radio shows.
Wow.
And I met Howie, and I came back and said, he played Laertes. It was the Fatigues they played Hamlet. I said, Howie, you were great. He didn't even say thank you. He said, do you have an act? Because he was looking, they were putting together acts for, I mean, shows for the troops to entertain the troops. And I said, well, I do have an act. And so he said, come and audition. And I told him, I'm going someplace tomorrow, Detachment 18. And my friend Saul Pomerantz, who was in Detachment 18, he says, go audition, see if you're any good. These are professionals that get a professional mark. And I went, I auditioned, and Alan Ludden and Maurice Evans said, we'd like to have you join us. And I said, well, I can't. I'm going someplace tomorrow. And they traded me out like a ball player. They called General.
That was it.
General Richardson of the Central Command, and they said, we need this guy. And that's how I started touring.
Wow. Wow.
I realized my friends were going to Iwo Jima, and like a bad movie, I toured the whole Pacific and the Weetok, Saipan, Guam, Palau, Mogmog, Johnson Island, the Marianas, the Marshalls, and I ended up 1 year later entertaining my friends, my 317th Signal Battalion that I was part of as a teletop operator in Iwo Jima.
Wow.
J-Day, on VJ Day, I'm the star of a show playing for my old buddies.
Wow. See, now think about that. First of all, thank you for your service. And second of all, what a great honor to be able to do that, because that was just as an important service as anything else in the military, was to keep the spirits up of our soldiers.
That's what they told us, and we believed it. And we were thankful. The audiences were tremendous. They were so appreciative, and it made a lot of noise, and we really knew that we were doing good.
Well, and then came the groundbreaking Your Show of Shows, and we'll talk about that next with Carl Reiner here on 720 WGN.
Reporter Carl Reiner here at LaGuardia Airport, awaiting the arrival of a plane load of eminent visitors, among them the distinguished Viennese authority on leisure domain and one of the world's greatest magicians. Here he comes now, Professor Hocus Von Pocus. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening, Dan.
Professor Von Pocus, I wonder if you could tell me something. You've seen Professor Von Pocus. Professor Von Pocus.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell me, who is the most unusual magician in the whole world?
Oh, the most unusual?
Yes.
The most unusual that I've ever seen was Rodini.
Rodini.
Ah, was he unusual? I'm telling you, he was unusual. He had one thing there. He had a little kid. You know, a little kid, put him on the stage in the middle, and then he would look at him, you know, like this, and go, la. And the kid would rise right up off the floor.
Off the floor.
No wires, no strings, no ropes, no nothing. And then after he got him up a certain height, he said, fly. And the kid would fly up in the balcony, around, loop-de-loop, slap-de-lap, in, out, not, put power dives, fly all over the place. It was just unusual.
Rondoni was that great.
He was a rotten magician. The kid was a good flyer, that's all.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to television pioneer, the legendary Carl Reiner, on his career and his new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. Now, Carl, you came home from the Army, you performed on Broadway, and then, boom, in the infancy of television, you became a big part of a groundbreaking 90-minute live variety show in 1950, Your Show of Shows. How did you get that part?
Well, it was very interesting, but at the time, I was doing another show called in the beginning of television. As a matter of fact, I did a lot of shows pre-1946, before the people had sets, the Maggie McNellis Crystal Room, the Marilyn Day Show, really crazy shows.
But it was variety. It was variety. It was singing, it was dancing, it was comedy, that type of thing, right?
Yes. And one show I started to do in the same time the Show of Shows started, called the 54th Street Review, myself and Hara Belafonte and a couple of wonderful girls who became big stars later, were in that. And Sid was putting on this, it was called the Admiral Broadway Review for 1 year. And then the next year they were coming back as a Show of Shows. And Max Liebman had seen me on that show and invited me to come along as Sid's, second banana. And I was so pleased because Sid, as far as I'm concerned, was the greatest comedian that ever worked on television, ever did before or after.
So, you know, you were cast as an actor, but you became an integral part of a historic writing team that I don't think any television program have seen since. I mean, you think about Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Mel Tolkien, Lucille Callan, Joseph Stein, Michael Stewart, and later on in Caesar's Hour was Larry Gelbart and Woody Allen, but when I think about just the writing team alone.
I know. As a matter of fact, well, I came on as an actor and I didn't do it. I was not invited into the writer's room until the third or fourth week. I was out in the hall while they were in. They figured I was just an actor. And I had always written my material and I knew I could contribute. So one day I came in and I said, I have an idea. And they said, what's the idea? I said, what about foreign movies? I knew Sid did the greatest double talk ever. Nobody could ever touch him. In my act, I did double talk, and I said, well, I'd never be able to do it on the show because Sid's the master. And I said, wait a second, if we did foreign movies, he'd have to talk to somebody, and I could be his. So they said, what are you talking about? I said, and I took a pack of cigarettes that were lying around. I went over to Sid, and in Italian double talk, I tried to sell him a pack of cigarettes, and he started to bargain with me, too much. And we they said, that's it. That became the birth of the foreign movies. And then I was in the writer's room from then on. And being in that writer's room was my college. I watched those great minds and those great, Tolkien and Brooks and Caesar and Callan and Tony Webster and Edward and then singing Larry Gelbart, who was one of the masters.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And the other thing is too, for a time in the 1950s, you were doing almost 40 episodes a year. So unheard of today with these shows doing 9 episodes, 13 episodes.
I know. That was the first year was an hour and a half. Caesar's Hour, after 4 years of shows, they broke apart. Coca went and did her own show, and Caesar went to do his show, and he did an hour. And so that was...
It was like a break.
Yeah, it was a break. It was easy. The hour and a half show was amazing because it was done on time. It was a live audience, and we didn't tape it. It was whatever we did. If we made a mistake, it was on the air.
Well, I was going to say, what was a typical week like in preparation for this? Because you aired on Saturday night, so were you literally working Monday through? Was this a 6-day a week, 5 days for prep before you did the live show?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, we had a very great schedule. Accidentally, we had a great schedule. The show of shows was rehearsed on started on Monday. Sunday we had off. We started on Monday. Friday we had a run through, and Saturday we had 4 run throughs. And the last one being the last one before the show, the penultimate show, was a dress rehearsal, a full dress code, and we went on live
with an audience. Did you have your dress rehearsal with an audience?
No, the dress rehearsal without an audience.
So the first time any audience saw the material was actually live in the show.
Right.
Wow.
And the only reason we were able to get laughs is that after the first year, they put us into a big theater in Rockefeller Center and had a huge screen that they could see what we were doing. You know, we were tiny little people on the stage.
Sure.
And they saw everything on this huge screen that was adjacent to it. And the laughter was there. It was for real.
I bet. No, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. The show ended, and then you know, as I said, you never stopped working. You know, your first novel, Enter Laughing, was published in 1958. Later adapted as a Broadway play and a feature film. You know, this was a big deal in and of itself, writing this fabulous novel.
Yeah, I think because the Army taught me to be a teletype writer. I could typewrite. So in the show of shows, there was a typewriter in one of the rooms. I used to sit down and write beginnings of plays, the cast of characters, and they were all funny. You know, I never went any past that, but that was the beginning of it. But I think my writing talent, I figured out the other day, I'm writing this new book. I think it came because my wife and I were married in the first year I was in the Army, and then we were apart for about 3 years. And we wrote letters daily. Sometimes I wrote as many as 3-4 letters a day. Once I wrote 15 letters, and I think that's where my writing began, because not only did I profess my deep love for her, but I also told her about what's going on in the mores of the time, and being humorous too, I write her, you know, some funny stuff.
So writing to Estelle when you were away is what really honed those skills. That's pretty cool.
I think so. And when I came back and I wrote some short stories, a bunch of short stories, that one night I went down and I wrote one and I gave it to Estelle. I brought it up from the. We had a little basement with a little room in it, and I brought up the story I'd written, a 2-page story. And she said, "Estelle, so where did you get that?" I said, "I just wrote it." "You wrote this?" I said, "You like it?" She said, "It's wonderful." I went down in the next 2 weeks. I wrote about 13 of them, and I decided to give them to a friend of mine who was illiterate, and he said these would make a great book. And he was a textile manufacturer. So he gave it to a friend to read, and he says, "You know, that friend read him and wanted to see me." And I said, "Hey, do I have to see this guy, Julian?" He said, "Yeah, see him." I said, "Why?" I said, "He's a he does pocketbooks. What do you? He buys his linings from you, textile." "He, no," he says, "Simon is just a pocketbook."
Wow.
And he's the guy who said to me, "Short stories don't sell, but novels are much more easy to market." So he said, "Write them." And I didn't know how to write. I said to my wife, "I don't know how to write a novel." She said, "I don't have enough words. I only went to Georgetown for a year." She said, "You have something more than words. You have feelings." She's the one who said, "You write it." And I wrote you know, that first thing.
Wow, and Answer Laughing came about. Then you launched a pilot that was the inspiration for the Dick Van Dyke Show, and we'll talk about that and much more with television legend Carl Reiner next on 720 WGN.
About 4 days ago, a plane landed at Idlewild Airport. The plane came from the Middle East, bearing a man who claims to be 2,000 years old.
Soft and cute.
Who was the person who discovered the female?
Bernie.
Who was Bernie?
Bernie, one of the feister leaders of our group.
And he discovered the female.
Yes.
How did it happen?
He
How
said,
did it come
hey,
to pass?
There's ladies here.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to television pioneer, the legendary Carl Reiner, on his career and new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show was Born. So, Carl, in 1959, you produced and wrote a TV pilot called The Head of the Family, based on your life on your shows. While you were on vacation one summer, this was your hobby. You wrote a sitcom.
Yeah, you know, they were offering me sitcoms after the shows died, until Carol Burnett resurrected it, thank heavens. 10 years later, the review format was dead. I was being offered, situation comedies, and my wife and I read them, and I said, these are no good. She said, why don't you write one? And I said, I can't write. So I said to myself, I said, what can I write about? I really talked to myself. I said, what piece of ground do you stand on that nobody stands on? I said, well, I live in New Rochelle with my family, and I work in New York as a writer. I said, I'll write about that. And a thing called Head of the Family was born. I was on Fire Island. I wrote a pilot. We sent it to my agent. He sent it to Peter Lawford.
Peter Lawford. I read that. That was your and his father-in-law being Joseph Kennedy.
Right. And he liked the pilot, put up the money for it. And I said, if I'm going to do a pilot, I better have a Bible for other actors, you know, to help me. So I wrote 13 episodes in Fire Island that summer. And I came in, and by the way, Peter, that was a funny one. Peter Lawford said, can I send one to Joseph P. Kennedy to see in the family? I said, why did I want to send it to him? He says, well, you know, he's the father of all of us. And he said, and he wants to know that anything we're involved with, it doesn't, the ethics and the morals are correct.
Wow.
I said, that whoremaster, that rum runner is going to the arbiter of my mom. And it was funny.
So true.
Anyway, so the show was, I did a pilot with Barbara Britton and Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles. It was okay. I was okay. And I put it aside because it just didn't sell. We put it on the end. It was fair. And I started to doing movies with Doris Day. I think I wrote a movie called The Thrill of It All.
Thrill of It All, yep.
But my agent, who was worried that he was letting gold lie on his desk unchecked, and he said, you got to come in and meet Sheldon Leonard. He gave Sheldon the 13 episodes, and Sheldon said he liked them.
He saw potential.
Yeah, and he said, and I said to him, I said, Sheldon, I don't want to fail with the same material twice. And this is a good impression of him. And he said to me, you won't fail. We'll get a better actor to play you. And he suggested Dick Van Dyke. I went to New York, and the rest is television.
Well, it is a television history, but even before then, Carl, okay, so you wrote Head of the Family, and before you launched Dick Van Dyke Show, you come out with this best-selling album with Mel Brooks, 2,000 Years with Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, which earned a Grammy nominations, characters you started on the old Sid Caesar shows. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. You never stopped working. Like, you just kept reinventing yourself from one medium to another.
Well, that was all. The 2,000-year-old man came about very strangely. The first day I was working in shows, Mel Brooks was working for Sid Caesar for $35 a joke or something. He wasn't working on the staff. But he was there, and I heard him get up. He was standing there. I don't know who he was, and he was doing a Jewish pirate. I'll never forget what he said. He said, you know how difficult it is to set sail today. I can't afford to set sail. You know what sailport cost? $1.37 a yard. I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore. And that was his first word. That is... The following day, yeah. I saw We the People speak about, you know, a news show. They recreated the news. And I turned to Mel and I said, here's a man who was at the scene of the crucifixion 2,000 years ago. Isn't that true, sir? And Mel said, oh, boy. I just his first words. I said, you were there? Oh, yeah. I said, you knew Jesus? Yeah, he's a thin lad, right? He wore sandals, walked around with 12 other guys. They always came into the store, never bought anything. I gave him a nice voice. Anyway, that was the first word spoken. And for the next 10 years, we did it at parties, in the office. Anytime there was a lull, I'd get up and interview Mel. He never knew what I was going to ask. I never knew what I was going to ask. And I was laughing hysterically as anybody else. And it was 10 years later, it's Steve Allen. Everybody told us to put it on record, and we said, no, it's the Jewish accent is persona non grata 4 years after the war. And it wasn't until we went to one of these Class A parties that were thrown in our honor so we can do the show that it was three people came up to us. George Burns said, "If you got that on record?" We said, no, he's put it on record or I'll steal it. And then Edward G. Robinson said, it'd make a play out of that. I'd like to play the 1,000-year-old man. We said he's 2,000. He said, I could play any age. I never forget that. And then it was Steve Allen, bless him, who said, fellas, you got to put it on record. I've got a studio, World Pacific. Take it over. Do anything you want. I don't want to be involved there, but I know there's a record there. And we asked 300 people to sit down on chairs, and we wailed for 2 hours, and the 2,000-year-old man came out of that. We edited it down to 47 minutes.
And a Grammy nomination, which is absolutely amazing. And so here you are, you know, a little bit of a bumpy road with Head of the Family, major success with the 2,000-year-old man. But then, you know, you brought the Dick Van Dyke Show to the screen with Sheldon Leonard. You picked Dick Van Dyke. You also had to find the right actors to play all the other roles. How did you end up casting everybody else?
Well, the casting of Rosemary was easy. My agent said, I got the girl in the office right now, Rosemary, for the part of the girl. I said, perfect. That was a pivotal part.
Sure.
And she said, and I have the perfect guy to play Buddy, you know,
Maury Amstutz.
I was thinking of a young guy like Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
But I said, wait a minute, Maury Amstutz, the human joke machine. I get a yard full of jokes. And so, and we did, he serviced everybody on the show when we needed a gag or a quip. He was sensational. And the only one that was difficult to cast was Mary. I said to Sheldon, I don't know what I'm looking for. I saw about 30 girls, 23 girls, actually. And one girl we flew in from New York, Eileen Brenn, a wonderful actress. But she was a little strong for Dick. They didn't seem to hit it together, so... We told Sheldon, we told Danny Thomas, who put up the money for the show, that we spent this money. And he said, who was that girl with the three names who came to audition for me for the part of my daughter? He said, she was wonderful, but her nose went the wrong way to be my daughter. He tilted up, mine tilts down. And he said, she was on that Richard Diamond show. She played the secretary. All you saw were her legs. With that piece of information I found, it was Mary Tyler Moore. I called her in and she was reluctant to come. She had a bad week auditioning and not getting jobs. And she stood there. She walked in the office and I saw this vision, beautiful girl standing on these beautiful legs. And I said, read this. I gave her one line, one page. She read the top line. I said, wait, hold it. I heard a ping in the voice the way I described it. I made my hand into the kind of claw that's in the penny arcades that pick up candy, you know, and
sure,
the machines. And I, with the claw, I walked across the room. She looked frightened, like I was going to do so. Grabbed the top of her head like I was picking up a candy bowl. And I said, come with me, young lady. And I walked down the hall and I said, Sheldon, you're right. I found her. And I unleashed her in front of Sheldon. And that was how we found Mary.
And that's how you found Mary. And I know some of the titles that were bounced around were like The Full House, Double Trouble, All in a Day's Work. And then came the Dick Van Dyke Show, where I believe Rosemary and the rest of America asked the question, what's a Dick Van Dyke?
Right. Exactly right. And Sheldon was saying, you know, Danny Thomas show is called Make Room for Daddy. I said, but Danny Thomas is a well-known figure. He was in nightclub for years, and And that was his choice to do that. I said, but because nobody knows who Dick Van Dyke, and because he's so talented, if we call it the Dick Van Dyke Show, I said, there is these morning game shows where the star of the show is, and the guy has nothing to do but ask questions. I said, those are not stars. Dick is a real star. I said, if we say he's a star, and once they test the show,
interesting, yeah,
we're going to be in. And after the first week, everybody knew who Dick Van Dyke was.
Absolutely. And the first episode was Sick Boy and the Sitter, really set the stage for the series right from the beginning. And I have to say, sometimes a pilot doesn't always translate in what you see in the rest of the series. This one absolutely did.
Yeah, we got better as we went along, too.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, and I'm saying this honestly to you, and I've said it before, that I still think if I was to rank my favorite show of all time that is timeless, 50-plus years later, it is the Dick Van Dyke Show. I mean, the jokes, everything. There's a lot of shows from those eras, Carl, from the 50s and 60s and the 70s, that because they use such jokes of the time and so forth, that it's very hard to translate to today's audiences. My kids, I have a 15-year-old, a 10-year-old, they laugh their head off at this thing. They always take bets, by the way, on if Dick's going to trip.
That's the best thing I hear there. You know, I assiduously stayed away from any jargon of the day. I used to tell writers, don't use any slang of the day. Talk English. The English we talked when we were, you know, when we came from school, I said, and we'll last longer. I said, if you call a gun a gat or a girl a moll, you're dating yourself and the show gets dated. I said, I knew we had something special. I said, if we keep the classic language, just the regular people talking, I said, we're going to last longer. And that was one of the few things I assiduously fought for.
Dick, I talked to Dick Van Dyke last fall, and he said the same thing. I said how timeless it was, and he said, man, that was all Carl. I mean, he planned that from the very beginning. Now, Alan, the character of Alan Brady, you know, I know you did it kind of off screen. You're back to the camera. You ended up doing it, of course, in front of the camera, which we'll talk about. But who was it modeled after? What was the character modeled? Was it Sid Caesar? Was it Milton Berle? Was it Jackie Gleason? Was it a combination?
It certainly wasn't Sid Caesar, because Sid Caesar was our dear friend, and we lunched with him every day. We went out to movies together, and we saw each other on weekends. No, he was a dear, dear friend. It was modeled after three people, and it was the three people you guessed one of them is Milton Berle, who had a whistle around his neck during rehearsal. He used to shout and yell at all of his crew and staff and writers. Jackie Gleason, who never spoke to his writers. They used to write a show and shove it under his door in his hotel room. He never spoke with them.
Wow.
And the other one was, Phil Silvers, who played a part called in Top Banana. He played an amalgam of these kind of, you know, loud-mouthed errands. So it was really a combination of those three guys. Certainly wasn't Sid.
Funny, funny stuff. And I'll tell you what, we're going to talk more with television legend Carl Reiner, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
Ready, Rob?
Alan Brady, Alan Brady, Alan Brady,
Alan Brady,
Alan Brady,
Alan Brady,
Alan Brady, Alan Brady.
Buddy Sherrill.
Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN, and we're talking to television pioneer, the legendary Carl Reiner, on his career and in a new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. So, Carl, the characters of Rob and Laura as parents, you know, no comparison to the humdrum characters of some of the other family shows and sitcoms at the time. They were hip, they were sexy, they were funny, not what you saw in a typical comedy at the time.
No, I think, I was reflecting, the only family I knew was my own. And if you reflect and write about what you are, you're not that different from anybody else, unless you're a murderer or a killer. there are not too many of those around.
Right.
But if you're a loving husband and father and your wife loves you and your kids love, I said, that's everybody. I said, so I wrote about what I know about, and that's what I was living.
And then at the end of the first season, CBS almost canceled the series when a sponsor pulled out, because at that time, sponsors had a pretty large hand in the programming.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, we weren't getting the ratings. We were opposite Harry Como's show. Harry was one of the, oh, he was so wonderful. And they were going to cancel us. Sheldon Leonard, we were only half sponsored. And Sheldon Leonard ran to New York and searched around for a sponsor, actually burst in on the Ken Cigarette. People were having some kind of a meeting. And he promoted our show, and he got half sponsorship. Of course, now we're not so proud that we're selling cigarettes, but in those days, we didn't know they were coffin nails. We just thought they called us, they're healthy for you.
No, I remember Dick doing commercials. I've seen them online. Yeah. He'd do commercials for Kent, yeah.
Oh, and luckily it only lasted a year. But then they were going to cancel us because our ratings were low. And I said, the Perry Como show goes off after the... Oh, they want to repeat our shows at...
Summertime.
At, very little money. For the summer.
$6,000 an episode, which is pretty wild, yeah.
And they said, no, it's not worth it. It's going to cost us more. And I was screaming. I said, no, I'll pay to have them put it on, because I said, if they test us without Perry Como opposite us, I said, they're going to find out who Dick was. And they did. They put it on for that little money. And the next year, the ratings shot up.
Yeah, they absolutely did. And this is what I find amazing. You wrote like 40 of the first 60 shows yourself.
Yeah, I was very lonely. No, I left. Yesterday, Mel and I were watching a half-hour situation comedy, and it was we were fighting for 15 seconds to do a 28-minute show. There was always, public service announcements. I was always needing a tag that took 30 seconds or so, and always fighting for 2 seconds. And here, my 28-minute show now is down. It got down to 23, 22. Now it's down to 20. So you can see all these wonderful commercials you'd never get to see. The Viagra commercials and Cheese Whiz commercials all bunched together. You like commercials, it's great. But what I was laughing at is when I saw these shows, and some are pretty good, but there it was. Producer, executive producer, co-executive producer, executive producer, friend of the producer, friend of the executive. There were about 20 producers' names before it got around to writer.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's just so different today than it was back then. I mean, and you, again, you were writing 40 episodes a season.
Matter of fact, it's funny. For 3 years, I was the story editor. In other words, on my own shows, if I had to do rewrites, I did it. I didn't get paid. If I did others, my own shows I wrote in 3 days. Other shows, when I had to rewrite somebody else, it took about 7 or 8 days. And I was paid for that as a story editor. And somebody said, you're a story editor on your own shows. You should get paid for that, too. Yeah. So it was after 2 years, it was Sheldon who said, you should be getting paid for story editing both shows. Anyway,
it's true. It's true. You were doing the job of so many people back then, and that's absolutely correct. You have so many names on these shows and I say this with all due respect, some of the people don't do a lot of work. You were doing it all. You were wearing many hats at that time.
And if it weren't for two guys, my nephew, George Shapiro, brought two guys to write a show and written a show. It wasn't very good, and I turned it down, and then a few weeks later, they hadn't really watched the show. I said, I don't know what our show is about. And they watched the show a few shows, and he came in with another episode. And I said, fellas, I don't want to turn him down again. He's read it. I read it, and it turned out to be the best show we did that year.
Amazing.
It was the one where the babies were twisted.
Oh, yeah. It was, let me see here. It was called That's My Boy.
That's My Boy. And they saved my life. Bill Persky and Sam Denoff started to write for me, and then in the third or fourth year, they became co-executive producers. And the last year, when I went to do Russians Are Coming, they actually produced the last 8 or 10 episodes.
But that was when the flashback was when they brought Richie home. Rob thought they had the wrong baby. And then the parents that they thought may have had the wrong baby were black. And it was in the midst of, the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And, you just handled it with such class. I mean, it was just so well done.
I was so happy with that. We lived in a white neighborhood. That was a white neighborhood they lived in. And as a matter of fact, a couple of years later, we wrote one about an FBI agent, Godfrey Cambridge.
Okay.
In all of those years, we had like two people of color. And I remember when I used Godfrey Cambridge, the studio head, they had, well, a CBS call. They weren't objecting, but they said, you know, you've got that, you know, African-American as a FBI agent. Are there really, Negro African-American agents? I said, well, if there are, there are now.
And, yeah, amazing.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
I wanted to get him into the show somehow. I mean, Godfrey Cambridge was a brilliantly funny comedian.
That was a great episode. And there was another iconic one, which is when we saw your first your face for the first time. And that was when you played Helen Brady in Coast to Coast Big Mouth. I mean, that is probably one of the most iconic episodes of the show.
Again, that was written by Persky and Denoff, and it was. And matter of fact, the reason I didn't turn around for the first couple of years is because I didn't want the audience to say, that's not a star of a television show. He's a second banana of Sid Caesar. So they wrote this show that was so, it would be unfair to the show if they didn't see who I was. And that show was one of my favorites to perform and to be part of.
Well, I know you said it was one of your most satisfying theatrical experiences, doing that episode. Yeah.
Well, and Mary was hysterical in it.
Yeah. Absolute classic. I don't think she knew. I don't think anybody knew, but I don't even think she felt confident from what I've seen in some of the interviews that she's done, that she knew she had the comedy talent to do what she did. And she really knocked it out of the park.
Oh, yeah. Well, she, after the first couple of show programs, she got it. And she turned out to be one of the greats of all time. I mean, her own show set the template for women forever.
Yep.
I mean, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was a piece of brilliant work.
And then as Alan Brady, you know, your poor brother-in-law played by Richard Deacon, first of all, he was hysterical in his own right. But, I mean, the famous phrase that you yelled at him constantly makes me laugh every single time.
Shut up, Mel.
Shut up, Mel.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, some of the books that came in, the first flush of the books, just the test market came in, where they came in a few hundred books, and six people wrote and said, would you please write, shut up, Phil, shut up, Ed, shut up, Don. I wrote, shut up.
You know what? I'm gonna ask you to do the same for me, because now I have to. That's perfect.
All right. And then I'll put an asterisk. I'll say shut up, and I'll put Alan Brady, but I'll put an asterisk played by Carl Reiner.
That's fantastic. I love it. Well, there are so many more amazing stories, and we're talking to television legend Carl Reiner, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
Your book's going to be a television series?
It's true. Of course, I won't do it till after my series is defunct, which may never be.
Alan is going to play me.
Yeah, and the three of us are going to write it, and Leonard Bershot is going to produce it.
That's right.
Wait, hold a second. Honey, what do you think?
Oh, gosh, I don't know what to say. Alan's really going to play you?
And Rob won't have to shave his head. I'll wear a toupee.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to television pioneer, the legendary Carl Reiner, on his career and his new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. But then, you know, here you did five seasons, and when I talked to Dick, he said, you know, you knew all along that you probably just wanted to do 5 years of the show, and that might just be enough.
Well, you know, 5 years of the show was 158 shows.
Yeah, jeez.
They do 20. And we knew that we started to, like, not repeat, but I said, let's go out winning. Let's go out winners. A boxer who fights one too many fights gets punch drunk. I said, we're at the top of our game now. And Mary was starting to, they were looking for her on Broadway.
Yeah.
Dick was now starting
Disney.
A movie career.
Yeah.
I said, we're just, I don't want us to be a second generation or second thought. We're first line. And so I said, let's go. And everybody agreed, and it was the last few shows were some of our best.
Absolutely. No, they
we
absolutely
saw the end of the tunnel, and we were not rushing to get there. We went there on, you know, the regular speed.
Well, and your new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born, chronicles all of this. We only shared some of the stories, but it's filled with, and this is what I love about this, because I know there's been Dick Van Dyke shows in the past. This book is so much filled, first of all, with your personal stories and really behind-the-scenes stories, but pages upon pages of amazing photos that I've never seen before.
Hey, by the way, you like the little bonus at the end?
The scripts?
I put in a copy, a yellowed, and they were, I found them in my garage, a yellowed copy of Head of the Family and a yellowed copy of one of the episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show with handwritten notes in it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I love that.
Everybody got their own personal
own copy of the scripts.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Incredible career. You know, you did so much more television and movies and Broadway. The lists are endless, and you are not only a television pioneer, but a legend in comedy. I was, you know, 7 Emmys for the Dick Van Dyke Show, 2 more Emmys for Enter Laughing, 79, The Jerk debuted with Steve Martin and all his other great movies, guest appearances over the years on the hottest shows, Mad About You and Ocean's 11, 2 and a Half Men, Parks and Recreation, American Dad, another new book, I Remember Me, and you're working on another book as we speak.
Well, I've got 2 books I'm working on. One is a novel. I haven't written a novel since I wrote All Kinds of Love, which somebody, Stuart Ross, who did Enter Laughing into a musical, is thinking of making into a Broadway musical, and I love that show. That was a book that flew out of me in about 6 months. I wrote a first line. I didn't know where it was going, and I said, that's really where I write. The line I wrote, I never forgot it. I said, he never realized that hiring a Japanese tutor would have the impact on his marriage that it did. It's a line I just wrote because I had Japanese food that day. and that turned into a 300-page book that's now becoming a musical. So you never know.
No.
So I have a novel there called that's in my desk called The Lovely Lady Ashcourt, and it's got about 10 pages up. But I also have another one that I'm working. I have 2 of them. One of them is called, which I told you about, Me at 93. That I'm almost finished. But there's one that I wrote a while ago that's being it's being finished now. It's being illustrated. It's called You Say God Bless You for Sneezing and Farting. And that was a true thing that my little 4-year-old granddaughter passed wind, and she said to her friend Leo, don't you say God bless you? And he said, no, you say you're only for sneezing. And she's, no, it's for sneezing and farting. And I realized that that's a book in it. So I wrote this book, and
that's
it's now being illustrated. And the interesting thing is that I'm not the first one to write a book on farts. There's about 20 of them, or 15 of them, that have written. And the first one was written in 1760.
Oh, geez.
By a man named Benjamin Franklin, and I bought it for $15. It's a lovely book called Fart Proudly.
By Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin.
That's amazing.
And because since then we found that suppressing gas is deleterious to your innards. It's meant to be passed. If you keep it in, you're not helping your digestive system at all.
That's fantastic. I look forward to that as well. And I will tell you, we only dipped into a piece of your career, so we'll have to have you back. I'd love to talk to you about your new books coming out as well.
I love talking about myself, and you make it easy for me. You sound like you mean what you're saying.
I absolutely do, and I love this new book, Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born, available from Random Content for a limited time. You can also order a copy, and Carl will personally sign it as well, and we'll put a link on the WGNRadio.com website and our Facebook page as well. Carl, what a thrill, first of all, to talk to you. So happy to see that you never stop working and continue to entertain us after all these years, my friend.
I love the synchronicity of this call, because when I said at the beginning, not 10 minutes before, a load of books were put into my shed in the back, and we have them waiting.
They're ready to go.
I can send to the to send out yonder.
I love it. I love it. Thanks again, Carl. I appreciate it, pal.
Thank you.
All right. It's 720 WGN.
Yeah, I always said you were the top comedian, Alan.
Shut up, Mel.
Yes, sir.